Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
Frank van Gansbeke acquired more than 30 years of global senior executive experience with the corporate finance and capital market fields at Fortis and BNP. Frank teaches as executive scholar in residence within the Environmental Affairs Department at Middlebury College in the United States. At COP26 in 2021, he co-founded Bayonne Bretton Woods, a think tank platform reviewing the international financial architecture and fostering the foundations for a fair, nature-centric, and regenerative financial system. Frank is a regular contributor to Forbes Online, where he's sharing new international finance thought pieces. Thank you, Frank, for speaking to us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Let me get started by mentioning a Forbes piece that you authored earlier this year on the Ukraine and Russia war, in which you discuss the effects of the Russian invasion of Ukraine on global powers such as China and the European Union. Specifically, I was interested in your description of how the invasion exposed some strategic shortcomings of the European Union, including not only, and this has been much talked about, excessive reliance on Russian fossil fuel imports, but also overlooking the importance of cyber intelligence and permitting the illicit funding of political parties by Russia, which then led President Putin to perhaps feel that he could invade Ukraine without a strong European backlash. And yet, Frank, as you well know, the response from Ukraine's allies in Europe and in other countries, including the United States, has been impressive. And this war is turning out to be a big headache for Russia, as we have seen, especially in the last couple of months. How do you see the future evolution of this war and its consequences for the rest of the world?
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Augusto, for offering me this opportunity to share my views and to engage with you on this podcast. It's a true honor. Coming back then to your question, I think, you know, very much you're right. If we underscore the elements where Europe failed, and this is, you know, unfortunate, if you look at the idea from emanating from the 1945 end of the war, where there was a desire in Europe never to see war again on their soil. And with the 1960s, we had the Treaty of Rome, whereby we had the fostering of free transfer of goods and services, people and capital. And now we see this very unfortunate kind of development of events since March of this year with the invasion of Russia into Ukraine. And you rightly said so. I think, you know, what have been some of those elements that led to those weaknesses, or at least these apparent weaknesses for Russia, you know, to take on this invasion? And you're totally right. I think, you know, there was a absolute failure to make sure that we decarbonized in Europe, and I say we, because I'm still talking as a European, you know, we decarbonized to a sufficient extent in Europe. We're still 80% dependent on fossil fuel, 20%, you know, for non-fossil fuels. And that is notwithstanding the warnings we received in 1956 with the Suez war crisis. We had another crisis warning in 1972, 73 with the Yom Kippur war, and now we have this one at hand, you know, in March of 2022. You're totally right too in the cyber intelligence. I think it can't be underscored enough, and I think, you know, it was epitomized, you know, with the attack a couple of weeks ago on Nord Stream 1. Again, we're totally unprepared, not in a position to thwart the attack. I think, you know, that was shown that the absence of really stellar kind of cyber intelligence infrastructure was in a position to thwart that attack. But I would like to underscore further strategic failures that have happened over the time. So we still have, you know, an element that in Europe, we are faced with the need to undertake our data cloud management with US servers or a majority of US servers. We have, we're faced with the fact that if we think about the transition, the 17 most precious earth minerals are majority owned by China. And also would like to again mention, notwithstanding what I would call one of the successes that have been reached by Europe is the common agricultural policy. Notwithstanding that, you know, we are for 40% dependent on Russia for ammonia, you know, which is an essential ingredient for our fertilizer, and more than 15%, you know, for potash, again, dependent on Russia. So in my view, I think, you know, what has happened is that Europe, to an extent, we could say, has been sleeping at the switch, but it maybe has been unfortunate in milking the peace dividend maybe a decade too long, right? So now, to your point, I think it's, if you say the retaliation on the West has been very, you know, decisive, and it's correct, I think, you know, from a military point of view, but I think it's also very important to see to what extent what drove Russia to undertake this. And it's foremost their retaliation for the crisis that was imputed by the West and by IMF on Russia in 1995 and 98. I think it was also the fact that Russia, and especially Putin, was refuted when it was offered to become a member, a NATO member, at the beginning at the early 90s. So that was, you know, two elements, you know, that still reside very much as revenge seeking for these refusals that have happened. And so there is an element here where Russia is now trying to seek to monetize, you know, its position as a maverick geopolitical player. So to your last question in the segment, how long might this war pan out? There are different kind of elements. I think, you know, notwithstanding the financial sanctions, Russia has been building up its trade balance surplus to about $250 billion. It also has actually been in a position to see the ruble strengthen. I think, you know, the ruble has been the only currency of all the global currencies that has strengthened in against the U.S. This year. It moved from 137 rubles against the dollar to 61.4 when I checked this morning. So this has been a 223% increase in value of the ruble. And so if we now look, you know, so there have some, there is some, you know, firepower available, and of course with the illicit backing from China. But, you know, if we look at what is the potential time frame, I think I would invite everyone to look so that Russia might maybe try and span this war at least until, you know, November 24, because we have elections in the U.S., with a change in presidential candidate or elected president. I think there might be also a potential for less, you know, inclination on the back of U.S. to actually engage with more resources into this war. There is an element also that a second winter might be much under shortage of Russian supplies of gas and oil, might be a much harsher experience for Europe than the one this is currently faced with. So in the meantime, it's also offering China, with this front that's opening up in Europe, to give sufficient time, reflection, preparation in terms of resources to actually start thinking about its next geopolitical move. So these are about some of the elements I would like to share with you and your audience in terms of how much or how long this war might still pan out.
Thank you, Frank. Very interesting comments. On the strengthening of the ruble, perhaps the only comment I would make at this point is that this obviously reflects the imposition of capital controls. So I would argue that perhaps this strengthening is in some sense, you know, artificial. It's It's not a reflection of businesses and other people in Russia being able to freely access the market and purchase foreign currency. That is largely proscribed at the moment. But in any case, let's continue on. In the same article, you also examine how the Russian invasion of Ukraine plays into China's interest of undermining Western global power. You argue that since 2008, China has been seeking to become perhaps the dominant power in the world, as well as obtain global reserve currency status for the renminbi. Furthermore, in February of 2022, as we know, China and Russia established a so-called no limits partnership involving mutual support and various forms of a collaboration. As a result, China's support for Russia was vital in the decision to invade Ukraine. My question to you is, will China's role in this conflict create a dependency by Russia for political and economic support? And furthermore, how do you envision a Russia-China bloc affecting the global balance of power in overcoming issues such as climate change and you know, other areas where international cooperation is necessary to address some of the global challenges that we face?
Yes, thank you again for those questions. I think, you know, we have to start off with, you're totally right. I mean, in 2008, as a result of the globalization effort and some managed tweaking of its exchange rate. So I think, you know, with the massive kind of exports that China saw, it was able to generate US dollars. And notwithstanding being made a member, being allowed to become a member of the World Trade Organization, not one single European or American, or for that matter, any other member ever dared to contest China in the tweaking or the management of its exchange rate reserves. So it has never been engaging in selling as such, you know, the US dollar and buying the renminbi. As such, it would make its exports a lot more expensive. Instead, it was building up this up to the tune of 1.1 trillion in US treasury. So I think, you know, it just redeployed the received dollars into the purchase or the investment of these US treasuries. 2008, all of a sudden, they realized that, you know, that was something, an asset that was deemed to be a safe asset, all of a sudden was illiquid and there was no market for that. So from that moment on, China said, okay, we need now to come up with an alternative kind of system. And definitely, I think, you know, it started the proponents to instigate this alternative reserve currency opportunity for the renminbi. And so now this has been given impetus, I think, over, or it's arching, that ambition is arching over the five major areas. And now these five major areas are important in relation to China. So first and foremost, I think it's trying to establish this independence in food and agriculture. So this is, it's buying swaths of land in connection with the Belt and Road Initiative in Africa. That effort is undertaken and sometimes supported by the Russian private group Wagner, by the way, named after the German composer. For example, in Mali, I think, where it's you know, been receiving assistance from Russia. Secondly, again, we're coming back on energy and its access to these precious earth minerals. So I think, you know, China has already access to the 17th most precious earth minerals that are going to be key and foundational in assuring this transition to a decarbonized economy. But also in this war with, you know, where Russia is engaging, it is buying very much on the cheap gas and oil of which it is deficient, right? So China doesn't have these natural oil reserves. Thirdly, it's actually engaging in a major global infrastructure. So I mentioned already the Belt and Road Initiative. It's investing in about 150 countries, major infrastructure, you know, from roads, schools to hospitals. But also, very opportunistically, I think, you know, at the time of the 2012 euro crisis, it bought one of the most strategic geopolitical positions. It was the Piraeus Harbor, so next to Athens. It bought it as part of a debt restructuring deal with Greece. We all know about the technology, I think, with Huawei and, you know, the 5G, to what extent this technology has been tested, you know, the spy features and population control are being tested on, you know, the population, the Chinese population. And last but not least, I come to this international finance ambition. So we have seen that China established the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. So this is as a competitor to the World Bank. It has already to the tune of $2 billion approximately forgiven 17 interest-free loans in African nations. It has engaged in a bilateral matter with Zambia. Zambia, the largest copper exporter and producer, away from any involvement of the Western nations and IMF. But also, very importantly, I think, you know, we're coming back to this war and the sanctions that were imposed on Russia. So now the Central Bank of Russia is totally excluded from the U.S.-based or the U.S. Inclined financial system, which has given the opportunity to all the financial engineers in both Russia and China to come up and work on an alternative system. On the quiet, but also under the imposition of those sanctions, has given them a major impetus. So why is Russia now becoming important in this ambition? I think, you know, China is, quote unquote, using Russia to fight some proxy wars on its behalf, you know, on Ukraine, in on European soil, in Mali, where it's chased the French troops. And Mali is very important, you know, as to access for uranium. You know, France is very dependent, I think, for more than 85% of its energy on nuclear. And so this access or the cutoff of uranium in Mali has been a very, very crucial beating for France in that regard. Secondly, I think it's, as mentioned before, it's creating, is allowing to create that front in Europe, again, giving time and resource to China to consider and prepare for its next geopolitical move. And again, it's buying in this again from Russia, this oil and gas on the cheap, given the developments that have taken place in the market. Now, to your last question, I think, you know, what could China's role become in this conflict? What could now happen in if there's a closer China-Russian bloc in terms of, you know, our ways to manage in a very favorable way our planetary boundaries? So we do know, for example, that there is a major threat if there is an immediate thaw of the permafrost in Siberia, so on the eastern, in the eastern region of Russia, because underneath the permafrost there is about methane. There's a huge amounts of methane. Methane is 24 to 26 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in terms of greenhouse gas intensity. So this is a major, major threat. There is, of course, also the ice sheet on the Barents Sea, again, which might be a tipping point, environmental tipping point. So now, now specifically to your question, how could this joint alliance between China and Russia be used? So I think now this is some thinking outside the box. We might use the model from Korea, where there has been a demilitarized zone been created between the North and the South. One could envisage a similar kind of concept for the southern part of Ukraine, all the way up to the southeast with the Donbass region, and make this demilitarized in exchange for third-party certified satellite verified joint efforts on China and Russia to avoid or to thwart or to mitigate as much as possible this permafrost, you know, unleashing of the methane reserves. So that would be one of the concoctions or one of the elements that would could be bringing both, you know, a peace which is needed very urgently, along with a address of our one of our most threatening tipping points that we have in, on the planetary boundaries front.
Let me shift gears a little bit. As part of your work, you support various companies and NGOs at the intersection of sustainable development and financial technology. And in 2017, you spoke to students and faculty at MIT about GIVE, a crowdfunding platform for sustainable development. Tell our listeners briefly about this initiative, the aim of which seems to be to give people a platform to be exposed to and make meaningful contributions to various global investment funds. I'm particularly interested in understanding how this platform was targeted for millennials who are disappointed or upset about the current lackluster progress on the sustainable development goals and want to help change this. What role do you believe platforms that engender public support such as GIVE play in promoting the SDGs? And can we begin to incorporate unique financial technologies into discussions of accomplishing the SDGs or more broadly, you know, promoting poverty reduction, gender equality, and what I would call a more equitable sharing of the benefits of rising prosperity and economic growth?
So the project at the time involved, to borrow from, or at least imitate some of the successes of Amazon that were established first in the book space and then later on a full gamut of goods and services. But, you know, to come up with something akin to what Amazon was offering for investment products to, at the time, millennials, by now you could also involve the GSEN a kind of population segment. And it would offer, on one side, in terms of the demand, involve students the opportunity to invest at a young age into products and services that are fully aligned with their vision of the world and their concerns of the world, especially the environmental concerns. You have mentioned the SDGs, so these are the 17 Sustainable Development Goals that have been articulated. There is the other term that you mentioned, ESG, so the environmental, social, and governance concerns. And there has been recently some backlash, but I think it would also allow for the products or these universe to mature. So this was on the other side, offering that the supply would be offered by the established players, the Vanguards, the Templeton Asset Management, Wellington Asset Management firms, to come up with products and services that are tailored to what the younger generation was looking for. And again, with a footprint to improve some of the societal outcomes in terms of injustice or some of the poverty ambitions or some of the carbon footprint or the pollution footprints that we currently faced with. And so come up and offer products, investments, and services that would meet and match those demands. At the same time, it would also expose some of the green washing elements, in the sense that the younger generation is far more reactive and ready to switch to social media in order to address some of the concerns they might see with an investment product or service that's not aligned or fully aligned with the ambitions they signed up for. And on the other hand, it would allow the established investment industry to use this platform as a lab to further chisel away at improving the caliber, the quantity, and the intensity, and the performance of their products.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. We'll come back to some of these issues in a couple of minutes, because I think there is a lot more to explore. But in the meantime, let me ask you about another initiative of yours. At COP26 last, I guess it was November, you co-founded Beyond Bretton Woods, an NGO focused on assessing and reforming the international financial structure. You suggest that while the Bretton Woods institutions have been an important accomplishment in the area of international cooperation in the last several decades, the world has changed enormously. And as a result, the international monetary system needs to evolve as well to fit today's challenges. I find this point very appealing, and I am very much in agreement with you. Now, in this vision, you have specifically underscored the importance of this decade as fundamental for the well-being of future generations. And here again, I find myself very much endorsing your view, especially in light of what is happening on the climate change side. What are the specific changes you believe must occur in the next 10 years or so? And why must we act now? Additionally, how do you think the international financial system can be modernized to fit these demands?
Yeah, I think to start off with the impetus for the initiative, which was undertaken together with my co-founder, James Vaccaro, was actually that we're faced with this eight-headed crisis in a decisive decade. So the eight-headed crisis, very quickly, I think we have the global health pandemic, including the mental health pandemic, which is not receiving sufficiently coverage, you know, from a global scale. Secondly, we have the loss of biodiversity. Thirdly, we have this tremendous social inequality, as seen with the wage gaps that have arisen over the last decades, the racial injustice. We also have the fact that we have financial fault lines. You know, just to use one metric, we have still $26 trillion as a result of quantitative easing. So these were the non-traditional monetary policy measures undertaken in order to address the great financial crisis in 2008 and the health pandemic. We also have the fact that there is we have the geopolitical tensions at the moment, you know, not to mention the war in Ukraine. We have the distrust in globalization, including democratically elected institutions. And last but not least, we also have concerns about the unencumbered access to water and stable food supply. So, I mean, this concoction of eight, what we call the eight-headed crisis, is something that we are faced with. And at the time, the designers of Bretton Woods could not foresee or could not come up with design features or architectural features that would make the institutions that emanated IMF, World Bank, that emanated from that era to actually tackle those issues in a very efficient and proficient manner. So, as you mentioned, we are in this decisive decade. So we are in, you know, 2022. I think if we look at this 10-year ambition here to reduce our overall greenhouse gas emissions, you know, for example, by half by 2030, right? So there is this element, you know, how can we achieve this? Again, we don't have too much time to waste from a demand perspective to meet and to come up and garner five to six trillion a year in order to foster the decarbonization investments that need to be undertaken. On top of that, we also have what we see are the adaptation needs. The adaptation needs are especially, you know, for the nations, the small island states, or the V20. So these are the so-called 55 most vulnerable, and the 20 has moved from 50. Sorry, we have moved from 20 to 55. So these are the 55 most vulnerable countries, representing about 1.5 billion people and responsible for less than 5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. So these people actually, or this, you know, the community there faces or is faced with a need of about 1 trillion in those adaptation needs. Now, from the supply side, we do realize that the World Bank and the IMF don't have sufficient ammunition or supply in order to meet those demands. You know, it's something that, you know, last year the World Bank dispersed in cash about $115 billion, right? So $115 billion, and we're talking about $1 trillion and $5 to $6 trillion on an annual basis. So this is a total disconnect in terms of magnitude. We also have seen, in the sense that the IMF remedies are not working, right? So we see, for example, Zambia. I've mentioned already Zambia before, largest copper producer. We have Ecuador, ex-OPEC oil member. We have Ghana, largest gold producer in the world. And we see these countries, in the case of Pakistan, you know, there have been 20 times since independence of Pakistan in 1950, they have been knocking at the door of the IMF in order to clamor for assistance. And yet that means that, you know, over this time span of a bit more than 70 years, every 3.5 years, Pakistan has been knocking at the door. So the remedy is not working. Order is not. There is something also wrong with the allocation of the proceeds that have been dispersed. But some of it, the system is totally, totally broken. And on top of that, you know, we have, if you look at the Global South, they also look at a system, a financial system, which is run by the dollar, right? So right now, the U.S. economy on its own is representing about 20% of overall GDP. If you look at GDP globally, about to the tune of about 105 trillion, 110 trillion. And on the other side, overall financial transactions, global financial transactions are expressed to the tune of 90%, right? So this is a major element, real economy, 20% overall financial transactions in dollars, 90%. You could also wonder from a systemic risk perspective to what extent it is tenable and to what extent it is also something that is needs proper looking into. So now then to your last segment of your question, what could be some of the institutions what would be needed in order to modernize, you know, the current system? I think I would say there's about five major tenets. The first one would be we need to have a global carbon price. There's absolutely no reason to have a dollar-euro exchange rate that's applicable at the same time and at the same level in Singapore as it is in Vancouver, or that a dollar of ounce has a global price that we can't come up with a global carbon price in 2022. Secondly, I think, you know, there's also a need for new institutions, right? So the new institutions, thinking to the likes of here, the idea of Steve Waygood of Aviva, who has actually worked tremendously on the establishment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Finance. This body or this platform would take in the recommendations, scientific recommendations from the IPCC, so the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, from the World Meteorological Office, from IPBES about biodiversity. So all these scientific recommendations would be processed and integrated and translated into financial imperatives and financial recommendations for global, the financial community. Thirdly, I think it also look at an amended remit, right? So we could, you know, right now we could say, for example, for the World Bank becomes responsible for anything to do with mitigation. IMF becomes responsible for adaptation. Over and above, they could be responsible for global water and stable food supply management. You know, they could also be taken on the climate refugees as a result, sorry, the international refugee crisis as a result of climate change should be onboarded as part of their remit. There's also an element of cooperation, which is, you know, could be improved not only among the World Bank and the IMF, but also with the multilateral development banks. And the other thing, which is a, you know, a more kind of moonshot, but is also maybe the need for a new anchor currency, an anchor currency that is maybe also a limited in supply and tied to the carbon reserve, but that would foster allocation to the needs to which we're faced most with at the moment.
Very interesting, Frank. In a way, I sometimes think that what you're advocating is for the IMF to go back to its original roots in 1944 and Article 1 of its Articles of Agreement, which were very much focused on economic growth and prosperity, which, of course, in light of the challenges that we face today on the climate change side, you know, has acquired a different meaning than we had in the 1940s and 50s. Let me move on, and I want to use this opportunity to tap into your talents as a teacher and ask you to educate our audience by referring to a Forbes piece that you recently wrote entitled The IMF Coin Revisited. In this article, you advocate for the adoption of an IMF climate stable coin, which you contend would offer incentives for decarbonization across the IMF member states. Now, take us through this proposal, but I'm going to ask you here to assume that our audience does not know much about the world of stable coins, digital currencies, and so on. As I understand it, this climate coin would be valued at the amount of carbon dioxide abated by using greener energy sources and be linked to natural assets as well as investments in climate technology. So, starting with first principles and concepts, explain this proposal and its potential benefits to climate finance.
Well, thank you, Augusto, for this teaching challenge. Yes, in essence, I think, you know, if I may bring your audience back to some essential features. So I think, you know, what we're, and this is the moonshot ID, by the way, but what we're trying to do is we use a currency for a unit of measurement. So we're trying to come up with a element to gauge something that we want to address. And that's away from, so the currency would not be used for as a means of exchange, like so it would you could not buy or sell goods with this currency. And thirdly, it would not be at this stage a store of value. So what you know could consider, for example, for pension assets. So this is the first notion. You would use this currency as a means to measure something. Secondly, I think it's also that we would offer this currency within the framework of the 2015 Paris Agreement. And so, and to bring your listeners back into the time frame, this is a Paris Treaty Agreement that was signed by more than 190 countries, and they all had signed up or committed to what is called NDCs, Nationally Determined Contributions. So again, it's a difficult acronym, but all it actually meant is that each individual country signed up its willingness to reduce, abate its individual greenhouse gas emissions, right? So that's the, so now the idea is to use and to link that commitment with a reward. And that reward would now be coming out of the IMF with this climate coin. So now the next step is, how would you come up with this climate coin? The climate coin is that the IMF is also using some vernacular, is SDRs, and again, it's this special drawing right, and the special drawing rights is nothing else than a basket currency. So the basket currency is composed of five countries, and I want to hold your breath, or I want to ask, you know, the listeners to hold their breath, because the main components are US dollar, renminbi, Japanese yen, euro, and last but not least, the pound. The pound is responsible for 7%, and if you look at some of the market volatility that has seen recently in a currency, you might still wonder what the pound is doing in this basket, but that's a side comment. So this is, you have this overall basket currency, and that's residing on the balance sheet of the IMF. The next step is would be to redeploy and convert these SDRs into our stable coin. And here we have the next definition of a stable coin. Stable coin is borrowed from the cryptocurrency world, but it's not a cryptocurrency envisaged in this framework. Stable coin means here creating stability in terms of the implied value of the currency. How do we foster, or how do we maintain that stability or that stable value in the currency is by actually making investments underneath or on behalf of that currency to back up the value. So the investments or the collateral value, as we call this, would be consisting of 40% of investments in land and forestry, 40% in top 1,000 global and most or the best managed sustainable companies. And then we have 15% investment in climate venture capital or climate technology venture capital, including natural solutions like regenerative agriculture, and the remainder would be cash. So you could see that these investments in its entirety would back the coin, in this case the IMF climate stable coin, and as such you can have a implied or assigned security or implied kind of stability to that currency. The element, as I said, now you already alluded to, or the IMF climate coin could now be set as a price signal for every ton of CO2 abated, right? So we have already price discovery processes underway with some of the cap and trade systems that are established in Europe, in China, in California. So we have already price points. So now we could, with this IMF climate coin, we could actually meet one of those ambitions that was stated and that would be part of a one of the new counter, the foundational points of the international financial system is to have, one global carbon price, right? So now you have hopefully all these elements together. So now you can move into for every country that's making an effort in case, you can take Mozambique, for example, it's taking this effort to abate X number of tons of CO2. It would be rewarded with this IMF climate stable coin, and then it could use it in a, it could sell the coin, or it could actually put it into repo transactions. So it could put it in collateral in exchange for fiat currency. With that fiat currency, it could buy clean, green investments or infrastructure investments in order to further abate their greenhouse gas emissions.
So would you agree then that the IMF stable coin, as you describe it, would allow for more oversight in climate change mitigation, specifically in helping countries achieve the so-called nationally determined contributions?
Correct. I mean, the whole idea is to make it also the major overarching idea is also to foster transparency. In something, it's that the Paris Treaty, unfortunately, for the larger public, is still something that remains too nebulous. It's not very clear, which country has committed to what. And it is actually even less clear to what extent what kind of progress has been achieved. Right. So now you can, by the use and the introduction of this currency, you make both kind of parties' commitments and rewards very clear, because a country would be invited to have its effort being third-party certified. And so it would be put on a carbon registry. So these are already existing kind of custodial accounts. Like, you have the American carbon registry. So these are elements that, whereby, this could be signed off and you have this effort been certified and acknowledged as a credit. And so the IMF, by releasing this IMF climate coin, then would remove this kind of credit from the carbon registry. And so now you have this climate coin now being assigned onto a specific country. We can go back to Mozambique. And so now, again, you can trace where the proceeds of the IMF climate coin are going to be used against, because the whole idea is to foster and to make each of the individual signatures, more engaged, more committed into their effort to engage in this climate mitigation effort.
Thank you, Frank. Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. Let me ask you one final question as we wrap up this very fascinating conversation. During the summer, you were invited as a participant to the so-called Bridgetown Initiative, which was hosted and launched by the Barbados Prime Minister, Mia Mottley, in the presence of very important global finance dignitaries. What is the purpose, briefly, of the Bridgetown Initiative, and what are the current hurdles to its success?
Yes, this was indeed a very captivating experience, and thanks to the vision of the Prime Minister here, Mia Mottley of Barbados. I had already referenced, the eight-headed crisis, and the fact that we are faced with the institutions that emanated from the Bretton Woods are no longer fit for purpose for those challenges of this eight-headed crisis. And you also have right now the concern that their dollar has a disproportionate kind of role, vis-a-vis, the underlying stake in the real economy. And So I think this whole thing has been epitomized by the experience of Pakistan. I think, you know, Pakistan is this prime example. Unfortunately, you know, the major flooding that occurred a couple of months ago, more than a third of the country was flooded, 4/5 of the livestock was killed, and you know, unluckily, 2,000 you know, casualties were to be recorded, and that number would have been much higher if it were not for the mountainous region of Pakistan. So the people actually were able to move up higher and to avoid the major flooding or major flooded areas. But the paradox that that Pakistan represented is that, you know, it is a nation at the forefront of climate change calamity risk, and yet its contribution historically is rather minute. Secondly, it's also the fact that the financial conditions that Pakistan is currently faced with, so this is in excess of 10% to borrow on the international markets, again, is in an inverse relationship with, again, its contribution to the greenhouse gas emissions. And thirdly, we also have seen, as I referenced earlier, Pakistan has been more than 20 times knocking at the door of the IMF for assistance. So again, either the remedy is not working or something is totally amiss with the deployment of the proceeds, or there's a combination thereof. So this is this kind of major element that actually gave impetus to the prime minister to set up this initiative. And so in its first instance, what it is trying to do is the establishment of what are the demand needs, you know, both from a retaliation mitigation perspective to an adaptation perspective, and mostly also focused on the V20. So these 55 most vulnerable countries, what are their immediate needs, right? And then secondly, how could this be, you know, supplied through the combination of the institutions that we already discussed, the IMF, World Bank, potentially new institutions. To the second part of your question, right, you know, what is a, what are the current hurdles that actually we're faced with? So contrary to Bretton Woods at the time, so we had the Bretton Woods, we had very clear, we had a Western bloc, and we had a, for lack of a better word, the communist bloc. You know, the world today is far more partitioned, and it's, you know, it is far more difficult to reach consensus among these diverging interests and parties. But also, if you look at, there are already some ongoing efforts. We have the IMF Resilience and Sustainability Trust, and there's been $50 billion that has been earmarked. I think a bit more than half now has been funded. And this is already a request that's outstanding for more than 18 months. The Debt Service Suspension Initiative, led by the G20, you know, was able to garner $12 billion. Another effort by G20, the common framework, you know, had interest by three parties, but not one single actually transaction can be shown for. So there was also the $100 billion in climate funding that was, you know, promised since 2009. Not one single dollar has been advanced, you know, in that framework. So that's, you know, one of these things that you see, that whatever the solutions that have been concocted, the execution is failing. The other, the other major element is the governance, right? So the governance of the Bretton Woods institutions, right? We all know that the CEO or the president position of the World Bank is actually always assigned to the Americas or the US, you know, the one at the IMF to the European region. So there is no words to say of, you know, the Global South and this overall governance. We have the G7 meetings. The G7 right now represent less than 22% of GDP. I mean, in the overall scheme of things, and yet the G7 is talking on behalf of the world. Right? So there are elements of representation governance that becoming painfully impotent. And then we're talking about the amount at stake, right? So we're talking about big numbers. As I said, you know, for this mitigation, we need 5 to 6 trillion annually, at least until 2030. And so, as I mentioned, we have the World Bank that dispersed in $115 billion in cash last year. So the discrepancy is, the imbalance is just enormous. So these are all the hurdles here that, you know, we need to come up with. And I think, you know, there's still belief and hope that, you know, these solutions can be found if we can think outside the box with, you know, these kind of challenges in our mind.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.